John Weitzman, our guest. John, take a few moments and tell us about the book Direct Action and the plot behind it.
Direct Action, the genesis of the book is kind of interesting. About 2.5 years ago, I had lunch with a fellow recently retired out of the agency who was part of the damage control assessment writing team after Aldrich Ames. And we were sitting over lunch, and he said, you know, one of the things that we thought about as we were writing the damage assessment is that CIA had been completely penetrated, that we were absolutely transparent to all our enemies, that all our programs, all our agents, all everything had been compromised. And we thought, wouldn't it be better if right now we created a kind of a covert directorate of operations inside the existing one, totally sanitary, totally...
Would he have been known to the others?
No, it would not. It would be a compartment unto itself.
Like a black ops thing.
Exactly. Okay. And he said, of course, it couldn't be done because John Deutsch wouldn't stand for it. Deutsch at that point, but during this process, was the director of Central Intelligence. But he said, you know, boy, that's the stuff of fiction. You should write a book about it.
And you did.
And I did. And the second element of the book is a lunch I had in Paris in December of 2003 with a fellow who was a one-star general running an intelligence unit in Iran under the Shah. And he said, Imad Mughniyeh, who is the second most wanted terrorist in the world after Osama bin Laden, was in Gaza this year. Have you heard that? And I said, no. And I thought that, and you know, I mean, we know that Imad Mughniyeh, who kidnapped the CIA station chief, William Buckley, in Beirut in the 80s, and who hijacked TWA 847, and who blew up the Marine barracks, and who blew up the embassy, the American embassy in Beirut, is in contact with Al-Qaeda. He, in fact, had meetings with Osama bin Laden in 1995 and 1996 and 1997 in Khartoum. And so this was fascinating to me because Mughniyeh had originally worked for Yasser Arafat.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, wow. And I said, have you talked to anybody at our intelligence agencies about that? And he said, they don't want to talk to me. I've tried. But again, he looked at me and he said, you know, CIA is in shambles. It is dysfunctional. You know, they won't listen to the truth. You should write a book about it. And it occurred to me that there is a better fiction book in this than nonfiction, because if I wrote it as nonfiction, nobody would believe it.
Yet, how close to the truth is it then, John?
Well, I think in terms of edge of the envelope, it's pretty edge of the envelope stuff. In terms of, I mean, this is a book about the condition and the morale of and the capabilities that we are dealing with now at CIA.
I mean, you know, when we talk about George Tenet, for example, did he not once say that 9/11? Was not an intelligence failure?
Yes, he said. He said that. I'm going to quote him directly. It was not the result of the failure of attention and discipline and focus and consistent effort. Failure means no focus, no attention, no discipline, and those were not present in what either we or the FBI did here and around the world. And I don't know what he'd been smoking before he said that.
I know it.
But now, George is not alone, by the way. The head of British intelligence said the following: I don't see 9/11 as a failure of intelligence. In terms of getting information others want to keep secret, 100% success is never achieved. Anyone who believes terrorist plots can always be foiled is living in a cloud cuckoo land and hasn't been paying attention. Well, the last part of it is absolutely true. You know, 100% success is never achieved. But as a failure of intelligence, nobody was listening. I mean, there were no American intelligence personnel in Western Europe who were fluent enough in Arabic to go, as Bob Baer did, to Edgware Road in London and look at the publications coming out preaching vehement anti-American in language that was just horrible, death to the Americans. I mean, you would go up and down Edgware Road, which is a Muslim enclave in London, right off Marble Arch, and if you read Arabic, that's what was there. But there wasn't an Arabic speaker at the CIA London station. At the CIA's Hamburg base, there were no Arabic speakers. So how could they track these?
You know, though, John, cells? Either they were so bad, I mean so bad, or they let this thing leak in for a reason. I mean, we are in a war economy now. We're going to be one in at least until the end of this administration, and then we'll see what happens, whoever gets elected in the next 4 years. This is going to go on and on and on. And the complexity of this country has changed overnight because of what happened on 9/11. I'm beginning to truly wonder if we just merely on purpose, not all of us, merely turned our heads and let it happen in order to then have an excuse for this war economy that will go on until the end of time.
Interesting question. I mean, I can only speak to the intelligence aspect of that. And the problem with the intelligence aspect of it is that it is not on a war footing. Look, in 1998, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency declared war with bin Laden. The problem was he didn't dedicate any efforts to that war.
Well,
he didn't increase his personnel. He didn't go out and find Arabic speakers or Pashto speakers. All that happened was he declared war.
Yet they had the signs. The signs were there. I mean, the Mossad let us know.
Well, the Mossad let us know. Anybody who had any smarts let us know. Look, the French let us know. Back in 1995, the French were, you know, having to deal with the Algerians, the GIA operating in Paris and setting off IEDs in metro stations. You were talking earlier about who's a good and, you know, what are the better intelligence agencies. The French have a superb domestic intelligence agency called DST, the Directorate for Surveillance of the Territory. And I must say that the French have a much better grasp of working counterterrorism these days than we do. For example, under French law, you can lock someone up for as long as 3 years before you do anything with them if they present a threat. Now, here, the ACLU would be going crazy after 5 or 6 days. But the French have taken a very no-nonsense view to terrorism, and in that area, at least, whereas they have not been supportive of us, and we have our own political problems with Chirac, and the French state is socialist. I mean, there are all sorts of problems there. But in terms of the intelligence stuff, DST is pretty damn good.
You know, the in the wrong hands, what the French government is doing, for example, would be devastating. Can you imagine a government that could go and put someone in jail for 3 years and just hold them there?
Well, yeah. I
with mean, no it's, proof?
It's what goes on in Saudi Arabia. You know, and it goes on in Kazakhstan, and there are people who are saying it's beginning to go on in the former Soviet Union.
And it may go on here.
Yep, and I don't think it's very different than that in the People's Republic of China either.
See, I think, in John, I happen to be one who thinks that there's a globalist agenda here. I think the globalists are getting exactly what they want, little by little, piece at a time. They're chopping away at things, and eventually they'll have everything that they want, and it'll be too late for anybody to say anything about it.
Well, we've had for years this kind of gnawing away at personal freedoms. And it's interesting how the left and the right look at these things. I mean, on the left, the Second Amendment is eaten away piece by piece by piece. On the right, the First Amendment is nibbled at piece by piece by piece. And I mean, so far as I'm concerned, you have these kind of Taliban mentalities on both spectrums, in both spectrums, left and right. When Ronald Reagan said less government is better, I think he was right. I mean, we at this point we've got this kind of nanny government. I think that's what George Will calls it, in which you've got people telling you what you can and can't read, or what can and can't be on your hard disk in a library, or people want to go see what books you've checked out recently. You've got products that tell the product maker that you've bought it. Every time you go to the supermarket and give them your check cashing card, your information is stored as to what you've bought.
That we're even getting to the point, John, where they're going to know where you are at every second.
Well, they're building devices into cell phones. I mean, it was funny. I was in Paris in January meeting with sources, and I met with one fellow who had worked in the arms dealing area. And before he would even talk to me, he made me take the battery out of my cell phone.
Smart guy.
Yep. And, he said, you know, it's not that I don't trust you, but I'd feel a lot better if, as we walk and talk, that either you're not taping me, or you're not broadcasting, mm-hmm. or somebody isn't tracking us.
Can you see the possibility that our intelligence has been stifled on purpose because maybe we didn't want them to find out things? Is that possible?
Them being?
Whoever they may be.
I don't think so. I don't think that anything this dysfunctional could be purposeful.
It's that bad?
I'd be afraid, George. Be very afraid. If you realize that it takes 7 to 8 years to create a good case officer, and if you realize that the culture of the Central Intelligence Agency, for example, stifles creativity, I read an op-ed piece recently that brought up a wonderful point, which was that the CIA puts prospective officers through extensive batteries of psychological testing and lie detectors and all of that. And the one thing they don't do is test for the capability to learn a language.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And if you think that we can go out and recruit people in Al-Qaeda, I mean, it's easy for a kid from California to get into Al-Qaeda, and get captured on the battlefield
mm-hmm.
in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in terms of getting case officers to be able to recruit the native speakers who can get in, because Al-Qaeda, we are, again, as I said, we're fighting the last war. Terrorism always in the old days was hierarchical, I mean, look at ETA. And look at the IRA, and look at Fatah, and the PLO, and the PFLP, and the Abu Nidal organization. All of those groups they were set up like the mafia. They had a head, and they had captains, and they had generals, and they had soldiers. Al-Qaeda is based on this cell-like organization in which you recruit a clan. You recruit a family. You recruit people who have known each other all their lives. These are more or less autonomous cells, which is why they're so effective, because they're very hard to penetrate. And to penetrate them, you have to recruit a clan member. And how do you do that?
Are you baffled that it hasn't exploded yet since 9/11?
Well, I think that despite itself, there have been disruptions. we have been very, very good, I think, in the financial area, in disrupting some of their financial stuff and exposing it. The Muslim charities here and overseas who were funneling money through madrasas into Al-Qaeda. I think some of that has hurt them. I think we've had some success in killing or capturing some of the mid-level and upper-level Al-Qaeda operators, and I think that has disrupted them. But they're a very persistent organization, and they don't think terrorist. They think military. They consider this a war. And I mean, if we look at 9/11 in terms of a war, and say it was our Pearl Harbor, we still haven't gotten to like Guadalcanal yet.
Right.
We haven't fought the Battle of Midway yet. We are still in the recovery stage from that. And again, it takes 7, 8, 9 years to get a case officer smart, street smart. It's a really tough job. We don't have a lot of institutional memory left at the CIA anymore. And that is a huge part of the problem. The old guys have all resigned or retired.
And they must be frustrated.
And they're hugely frustrated. I mean, I hear from them all the time. And they hear stuff that, makes what's left of my hair curl.
Did they ever say to you that they heard that 9/11 was happening and nobody was doing anything about it?
No.
They never said that?
No. I've never heard that anywhere, except in the usual conspiratorial areas.
Right.
Although that's one of the things that I built my previous novel, Jack in the Box, on.
And you know what? Sometimes where there's smoke, there is fire.
Sometimes, and sometimes it's just smoke.
Sometimes it's all made up.
Exactly, and that is why we need great intelligence agencies. That's why, you know how many commissions there have been? There have been like half a dozen commissions, and every single one of them has focused on the structure of our intelligence community, when these commissions should be focusing on the people.
Right. Which make it.
Yep.
I agree with that.
You know, you can talk all about management that you want, but leadership is the key. And allowing your people to operate is the key.
Which we don't do.
Which we don't do, no. The CIA is built on a structure imposed by Congress of these thousands and thousands and thousands of thou shalt nots. You know, thou shalt not recruit bad guys. I mean, 1992, a cable was sent out from CIA headquarters to every station and base worldwide, and it said, in effect, thou shalt not recruit Russians anymore. Because the Soviet Union is dead, and we are treating the FSB or whatever it was in those days, the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, as a sister agency now. Well, the Russians never stopped spying against us.
Never. That's
you
right.
know? I mean,
our friends are still spying against us.
Pardon?
Our friends are even spying against
our
us.
Our friends spy against us. We tend to think of this, I mean, as the newfangled way of going about it. It's almost as if we are in one of those old 1930s or 40s Ken Maynard or Bob Gibson.
So, John, what would you do to fix the Central Intelligence Agency?
Well, I guess the overarching concept would be to make it less like General Motors and more like the OSS. Less complex, less layers of management, more nimble, more efficient, more case officer friendly.
More reactionary when you get information.
Well, more proactive, actually.
Yeah.
I think, George. I mean, you could do it with a smaller group of people if they were allowed to operate. Also, there is this problem of shifting people around. The CIA, very much like the State Department, every 3 years will move their case officers around. And so if you're serving in Cairo at one point, then you go back to Langley for 3 years of desk work, which is great for your career, but you lose your Arabic, you know.
Yeah.
And then they send you perhaps to Costa Rica, so you've got to learn Spanish, as opposed to having specialists.
Who just know the ground.
Who know the ground, work Arab countries only, who develop networks, who don't depend on interpreters. And if you have a small and nimble, that's what Bill Casey did. What Bill Casey did was he took the Directorate of Operations and really found a coterie of people whom he could trust. And he had some marvelous successes, you know. I mean, somehow he managed to keep Solidarity alive after the Polish government declared martial law and Solidarity's leaders were arrested, but somehow appeared in Poland millions and millions of Solidarity buttons and posters and stickers.
How did we lose Iran when the Shah, who, by the way, was no Boy Scout, how did we lose that? How did our intelligence crumble on that one?
Well, we had a problem. We didn't have anybody in Paris who spoke Farsi. So no one listened to Khomeini's tapes. No one even knew he was there. We had nobody, CIA sent nobody to see him in 1979. I mean, don't forget, this was under, this was 77, 78, 79. It was under Stan Turner, who had dumped 800 case officers, amongst them many people who had good relationships in Iran. At the end, the CIA personnel was really dependent on the Shah's intelligence agency, which was called Shabak, as I recall.
Shabak.
Yep. They weren't going to talk about Khomeini, and I think we were blindsided. There again, language capabilities. To have case officers in Saudi Arabia who don't get out and talk to dissidents, I think, makes us blind in Saudi Arabia. To have to interrogate prisoners through interpreters, it's kind of like that old kid's game of telephone. And how do we know, by the way, that the interpreter is giving us the unvarnished truth?
Well, I've always wondered about that, when some interpreter is giving you some verbiage, if he's telling you what the guy really said.
Exactly. You know, I mean, if you think that, for example, the PLO and the Viet Cong both infiltrated intelligence officers into the American media, working as interpreters and fixers in Lebanon, PLO intelligence officers were interpreters and fixers and local help to the networks in Beirut. And in Vietnam, a North Vietnamese intelligence major was the office manager for Time Inc. And you don't want to forget that in 1971, Abu Iyad, the head of Fatah's intelligence, PLO intelligence, went to Hanoi and said, how can we guys do what you guys are doing? How can we change opinion about us? And one of the lessons he learned was, get your people into the American media.
Why,
and they did that.
Why can't we even find Osama bin Laden?
Well, of course.
Or do we know where he is?
I have a feeling that we know more or less within, like, 2,000 square miles where he may be.
Maybe even closer.
Maybe even closer. But you remember Eric Rudolph?
Yes.
It took the FBI 4.5 years to find him.
Yeah.
And that's operating in its own country. And
we found him only because of a blunder.
Exactly.
His blunder. And I guess he was talking to someone, and the guy called and reported it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think the same thing is true. And if you figure that part of the world is probably the roughest terrain there is, this is not like you could send, two divisions and have them walk, soldiers walk 3 feet apart I mean, it's impossible to deal with that terrain like that. Somebody's got to sell him out.
Eventually.
I think that's how we're going to get him.
I think so, too. Robert from Cincinnati wants to know about the CIA cocaine link, if you ever stumbled across anything in that in your work and research.
No, Congressman Maxine Waters and I agree to disagree about this.
Really?
There have been all sorts of allegations about the CIA running stuff into and out of Arkansas, and CIA is responsible for the crack epidemic, and none of it has I don't think, been proved to anybody's satisfaction.
Some
reporters
have tried.
Certainly not something for me to write about.
All right, okay. Let's see. Alan wants to know from Vancouver, Canada, can you please ask John what the role the press and the media have in going to war by not challenging bad CIA information? That's an interesting question.
It is. It is a good question. And we have, part of the problem is that our media, for the most part, is totally uneducated. I mean, if you listen to, you know, God bless C-SPAN for putting on like the Pentagon briefings and the White House briefings.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I've learned by watching them is that these people don't prepare. Each one gets a gotcha question. They want a, you know, a sound bite. They are absolutely not interested in light. They only want heat. And they don't prepare. They're not well-read, most of them. They ask obvious questions. They don't ask good follow-ups. They don't pursue the matter. And I truly believe that if the press had been tougher right after 9/11, you would have seen people being fired.
I think so too. And you know, going into Afghanistan had nationwide support, and now the president's popularity is at its lowest ebb because of Iraq. People are beginning to jump off that bandwagon in numbers, and that support base continues to go. Yet, I still haven't seen anybody from the mainstream media challenging the fact that we were there under a wrong assumption, and it's almost like, oh, well, it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, I think you're right, George. And I think also, I mean, we go back and remember about Afghanistan. If you will recall, the press, very much like the CIA and the military, fights the last war. And the most prevalent word within 48 hours after we started in Afghanistan was quagmire.
Yep.
I mean, that is, again, my argument that the press really has very little institutional memory. I mean, these... Most of the reporters these days are in their 20s and 30s. It is a young person's job. They don't read a lot of history, I think. I mean, I really don't think they understand. I don't think any of them understood Al-Qaeda. I think very few in the press currently understand Al-Qaeda. And I think very few in the press currently understand the dynamics of what the war and the insurgency in Iraq is like.
We hardly hear anything about the National Security Agency anymore. We used to hear in the old days, we'd hear about it all the time. Now it seems to have been swept under the carpet. What's going on there?
Well, there are various reports that come out. There was one recent report, whether it was a GSA report or a congressional research report, talking about the fact that NSA had not made as much progress as necessary in terms of its ability to make timely translations of intercepts. I mean, it's got evidently there the situation that occurred before 9/11, which was, you know, it gets an intercept saying, you know, a Christmas present is arriving. And won't the Americans be surprised or something to that effect? And it's not translated for 5 days. I mean, it's kind of like the cable to the commanding general in Pearl Harbor, the admiral in Pearl Harbor, that was sent by regular mail.
Yeah.
You know, before December 7th. It's a weekend. We'll just put it in the mail to him. NSA has had a lot of problems with its technologies, and I think it is slowly climbing out. Of course, it lost General Hayden, who had been running it, who had done, I'm told, some good work over there, and he is now Negroponte's number two.
Has the FBI fixed or replaced its screwed-up computer system yet?
No. The FBI's computers are kind of like 8088 processors. They could be using K-Pros or Osborne's, you know. Louis Free had the chance to do that, and he screwed it up. I mean, even now, there was a Department of Justice Inspector General report last year that said that roughly one quarter of all counterintelligence and counterterrorism intercepts are not monitored or translated.
That's a lot.
As I say, be frightened, George. Be very frightened.
What's the downside here for us, John?
Well, the downside is we keep the same intelligence culture as we've had for the past 20 years, and this problem of mega terrorism, Islamist terrorism, narco terrorism, Chinese expansion, Pakistani and Indian nuclear testing, North Korea. And Wahhabism keep going, and we don't know anything about it. That's the downside.
Does that mean we get weaker?
It definitely means we get weaker because you know, knowledge is power, and if you don't have knowledge, you're going to make mistakes politically. You're going to make mistakes in your statecraft. You're going to make mistakes in your relationships with other sovereign nations.
Aren't there many nations who would like to knock us off our perch?
Well, the Chinese stated so. I mean, there was this book written some years ago.
It's by some generals, right?
By two colonels, actually,
right.
Called Unrestricted Warfare. And it basically laid out a 25-year plan. Look, the Chinese now, currently, there are about 150,000 Chinese students at American universities. A good percentage of those students work for Chinese intelligence, which is known as the Airbu. And the way the Chinese gather intelligence is not the same way we do. They do it on a very broad but not deep basis. We try and find one person that knows a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese do it the way they dig roads. They put 20,000 people, and each person only digs 3 feet.
And they still get it done.
When I was in China at the end of the Cultural Revolution with President Ford, we saw one day as we were on a motorcade drive, a road being constructed that way. And for kilometer after kilometer, there were people with shovels. And they built the road in one day.
Just bang, it was done.
Yep. And if you figure that that's how they gather intelligence, so we have 150,000 Chinese students here, some legitimate students, others have been asked by the intelligence apparatus to gather one thing. And that has allowed them to, you know, reverse engineer a lot of our weapon systems. And they are intent on becoming a superpower by 2025, 2030.
How many of them could be soldiers? At any moment.
Lots.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big country.
That's,
you know,
exactly
it's a
what
big
I
big country. And what happens when China gets a blue water navy?
Mm-hmm.
What happens when they build?
Which is what they need. That's what they need.
That's what they don't have.
Yep.
They're already getting some Russian subs. They already have diesel subs, which, of course, our navy doesn't want because Admiral Rickover set up, you know, the nuclear navy, and diesels are beneath our navy. That is not suitable for our officers and gentlemen. But if you're operating in brown water, diesels, which are now, you know, self-contained, they can recirculate.
Still a little noisy. You can find
they're
it,
a lot
right?
quieter than they were 20 years ago.
Well, that's true.
You know, the Germans have an 80-meter. A diesel sub that's pretty damn quiet now. But, I mean, the Chinese have got brown water submarines and brown water ships, and now they're looking for blue water submarines and blue water ships. And that, again, is something we should be looking at.
What do you think this country is going to look like 20 years from now?
Boy, I don't know, because if I knew, I could be rich.
That'll be your next book.
Yes, indeed.
Just remember I gave you the idea, John.
I'm writing that down, George.
All right, 20 years. I tell you what, that'll be a bestseller.
You know, I think you're right.
And I can put you back on the show again, too.
Even better.
Yep.
Even better.
Let's talk for the next couple minutes about the Brits. They've been our partners lately in just about everything we're doing. You know, if there have been mistakes, they will do the same thing. So to me, it's almost like it's by design. Do you see that ever weakening, that relationship?
I think we've had ups and downs, certainly with them, but we have this relationship with the British, and we've had it, for years and years and years, certainly since Roosevelt's time. And I don't think that is going, on a political level, on a government-to-government level, is going to dilute anytime in the near future. Interestingly, I mean, I spend a fair amount of time in London, and there is huge anti-Americanism over there amongst the population in general.
Anti-government or anti-Americanism?
Anti-both. Actually, right. Both anti-American, you know, you Americans are, so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly anti-government. I happened to be in London in February of 2003 when 1.5 million people marched in an anti-war, anti-Iraq war protest, most of the. It's interesting that most of the signs in that had been bought either by the Daily Mirror, which is a vehemently anti-American tabloid paper, or an Arab-sponsored organization. And but the people turned out, and it was a hugely orderly. I think there were only 5 arrests.
John, when we come back, we'll take phone calls from coast-to-coast listeners just for you. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment.